welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Monday, September 14th, 2015. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, we'll speak with Bruce Van Dusen about the Polaris House. Maria Levischuk will be here to tell us about the Juno Vulnerability Index Survey. Rachel Wintz from AWARE will talk about volunteer advocacy training and nominations for women of distinction. And we'll speak with jazz composer Ingvild Vatn Gutu about her Alaska Originals concert with the Rob Cohen Trio this Thursday night. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more right here on a Juno Afternoon. It's currently 49 degrees at the Juno Airport.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In a voting rights case, the state of Alaska has agreed to provide increased language assistance for voters who speak Yupik and Gwich'in. KTOO's Lisa Fu reports.
The federal lawsuit was filed in 2013 by two Alaska Native voters and several tribal governments. The plaintiffs claimed state officials failed to provide oral language assistance to voters who speak Alaska Native languages. Natalie Landreth with the Native American Rights Fund is an attorney for the plaintiffs.
The choices that were made in the settlement opened the door for Alaska Native access to the polls in a way that we have not seen before.
The centerpiece of the settlement is translating the state's official election pamphlet into Gwich'in and up to six different dialects of Yupik. Landreth passes on a message from plaintiff Mike Toyakak, who speaks Yupik.
This is really a big deal for us, and we're very happy that those who could not understand before will now be able to understand the voting ballot.
Alaska has about 10,000 Yupik speakers and 300 Gwich'in speakers. For National Native News, I'm Lisa Fu in Juneau.
A tribal coalition is working on preventing substance abuse in Native communities in Wisconsin. WXPR's Miranda Vanderleest has more.
The Great Lakes Intertribal Council received a $4 million federal grant to tackle substance abuse in tribes in Wisconsin. Director Carol Wright says the council is partnering with the state to address the rising issue of youth binge drinking and prescription drug abuse. Wright says they've identified three or four tribes with high need.
So we are looking at collaborating. Theirs will be specifically on prescription drug abuse. So we've got some crossover, and we're working together so that both of these grants for the next 5 years will be having an impact.
Wright says the grant will work with the Lac des Flambeaux, Menominee, Lac-Couderay, and Bad River tribes to implement preventative measures. She says hiring prevention specialists and executing a data system for future prevention programs is crucial. However, she says developing culture-specific programs will be the most beneficial.
So things like talking circles, sweat lodges, activities that in the past kept communities healthy, that we find a way for them to be recognized as activities that truly do work for prevention in Native communities.
Wright says community assessments of the data collected will determine the progress of each tribe and will show what areas of prevention need more work.
That was Miranda Vanderleest reporting. In Canada, the political group Chiefs of Ontario has launched a digital fundraising campaign for families of missing and murdered Indigenous women. Ontario Regional Chief Isidore Day helped launch the campaign last week to raise funds and awareness for an Ontario First Nations-led investigation into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Day says they're determined to prompt a national dialogue and are taking the issue upon themselves. Earlier this year, a gathering for the families was held to get their input for First Nations leaders. The campaign included the website whoisshe.ca, which features testimonials and photos from families, video messages from First Nations leaders, and an online donation center. U.S. Senators Martin Heinrich and John Hoeven announced today they're introducing legislation to make the American bison the national mammal of the U.S. The National Bison Legacy Act also recognizes the historical, cultural, and economic significance of bison, including its importance to tribes. The species is acknowledged as a conservation success story through efforts to bring back the animal after it faced extinction. Bison now exist in all 50 states in public and private herds, which include wildlife views for zoos and parks and bison ranching and production businesses. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. And by the law firm of Sanofsky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Mumson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
Support provided by Shoshone Bannock Tribal Farms, proud producer of free-range, sustainable buffalo jerky. Holiday delivery of original, peppered, and teriyaki buffalo jerky available on orders placed by December 15th. More information at sbtribalfarms.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juneau Afternoon here on Monday, September 14th, 2015. Scott Burton, your host. And joining me now in the studio is Bruce Van Dusen. He is the executive director of Polaris House. Welcome to the show, Bruce.
Thank you, Scott. It's good to be here.
Nice to have you on the show today. I think a lot of us know a little bit about Polaris House. You're over on its Willoughby Place, kind of across from the Sandpiper and Iga and all of that. Tell us a little bit about what you do, Bruce.
Well, Polaris House, we provide a community of mutual support, a restorative environment to help persons who are living with a mental illness diagnosis to not only be comfortable and have a safe place to go, but to gain self-confidence and to establish themselves with better self-reliant type skills to access opportunities in the community.
What are some of the common mental illnesses that you see?
Well, for us, kind of call it the big three sometimes. It's schizophrenia, depression, and the bipolar disorder. Those are the three that we see most commonly. We do see a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder, and we see a lot of fetal alcohol syndrome, and there's quite a bit of anxiety-type disorders as well.
This is probably a big question. I was just going to, if you could, sort of tell us how... What are some common ways that folks with these, how it affects them, and why is it hard for them to work maybe or something else?
You know, one of the things we face with these types of diagnoses is that by the time that someone actually gets to treatment, they've had so many problems that they've been distanced by their family, probably have lost their friends, they've probably lost numerous jobs or haven't been able to complete formal education. So by the time they actually can get to treatment, it's gotten pretty bad for them. That there's a problem with, you know, establishing relationships, big gaps in a resume when they're looking for jobs. Some people have some real trepidation about using, you know, what we call traditional community mental health care or medications. You know, so it can get really bad in that sense, yeah.
Okay. And I read on your website about a clubhouse community. Tell us about what a day in the life at the Polaris House looks like.
Well, it's always very energetic. We have people in who are always working on something. I mean, they want to use resources to find or to get better housing, or they're looking to improve their education, or maybe they're into searching for employment. So basically, we structure our activity much the same way as any other business in the community. We get together in the morning, socialize a little bit, get ready for the work day. Then we have unit meetings, and the different units will meet, discuss what work needs to be done, and then the staff and the members will actually complete that work. And all of that work is actually what it takes to run the club. They work side by side with us as partners, and so then we go to a nice big lunch hour. We have a really great lunch program, to tell you the truth. We have really, really good meals. We do charge a minimal cost. It's $2 a meal. And then after the lunch, we again...
What time does that start?
Starts at noon.
Oh, good to know.
Yeah, right. We have really good stuff. I mean, we had, you know, chicken patties today with French fries and a salad. So, yeah, it comes out pretty good. I don't think you can get a better lunch in Juneau for $2. So we do that. And then we clean up a little bit, you know, and then at 1 o'clock, the units will come together, talk again about what work needs to be done in the unit, and then the rest of the afternoon we'll finish working.
And this is sort of a model that's been outlined by Clubhouse International, is
yes,
that right?
Yes, it is, yes. Clubhouse International is located in, the headquarters is located in New York City, and we have over 300 clubhouses around the world in over 30 countries, and so this model is replicated in many, many places. Polaris House is the only clubhouse accredited internet clubhouse in Alaska. We're working with the Division of Behavioral Health, the Alaska Mental Health Trust, to spread it and make more. So we're growing it. Clubhouse International operates what we call the 36 standards of clubhouse operation. And we need to meet those standards in order to maintain our accreditation. And so it's, we stay busy with that.
I bet. Can you give us an example of a couple of those 36?
Yeah. One of the ones that I use a lot is there are no staff only or member only meetings. We don't have any meetings where staff go off and talk about what's going on with members. We're very open. It's one of the things that we do is we don't have a distinction between clubhouse activity and treatment because we don't really provide treatment. It's very vocational. So that's a nice standard to have, that the members know that there's not going to be any closed doors meetings when their future is determined, so to speak. One of the other ones that we use is that all clubhouse staff are generalists. All clubhouse staff share in all of the work. That way, a member who wants to work in a unit at a specific job can choose the staff that they want to work with. So we can keep, you know, positive relationships. We don't accidentally drive people out because they end up in a unit not wanting to work with a particular staff person. One of the big ones that we use monthly at our club meetings is decision by consensus. If there's a problem, an issue, something that needs to be changed, something that needs to be improved, we want to reach a decision by consensus. And what that means for us is that we reach a decision that everyone can live with. If we had voting, 75% of people for, 25% of the people are against, well, that 25% of the people that get outvoted go away unhappy because, we're not meeting their need. So consensus, decision-making process is good.
Okay. I read that you have about 350 members. Does that sound about right?
Well, we had 350 members when I started. We're up over 390 now. Okay. We've been adding 3 to 5 members a month since I've been here.
Okay. So you're a nonprofit. You're located in the heart of sort of downtown in the Federal Flats here. What, as a community, do you need from us as support? And I know that you're also supporting the community. Right. It's a two-way street.
Yeah. The big one that we would like from the community is the opportunity for our members to be employed at jobs that really mean something. We have a transitional employment program where we plug persons into a job, not so much for job-specific training, but it's to help them get used to being to work on time, correct hygiene, communication with coworkers and supervisors, clocking in, clocking out, and those sorts of things. That way, when they get those skills in place, then we move up to supported employment or independent employment, and they can get the job that they really want. So what we're really looking for are these transitional employment spots with employers. It's kind of a win for the employer. The employer would train us staff, and that's the only training they have to do from that point forward. We train the person. They get guaranteed coverage. For whatever hours are supposed to be covered by that person, it's guaranteed. If that person calls in sick and they can't make it, we'll go cover it. We'll make sure that the work gets done. And since the person that will be doing the work has a verifiable disability, the employer can also claim tax credits for that sort.
Can you give us an example of one of those that's been successful in the past?
There has been one. Oh, it's the pizza joint.
Bullwinkles?
No. I was out in the valley. There was a pizza joint.
Papa Murphy.
Maybe it was Juno Pizza. But anyway, the TE spot, not being job specific, it was the person standing on the corner with the sandwich board advertising the pizza joint. Another one that we've been really working on is with Mendenhall Auto Group, a part-time lot attendant. They've been very helpful with that. Rainbow Foods has expressed an interest that we might be able to use to get one of our folks up there stocking, and doing that sort of thing.
About how many hours a week?
Well, the transitional employment program usually runs 10 to 15 hours a week. It's only 6 to 9 months in duration because, again, we're trying to get that person up to where they can get the job that they really want. But as long as we're doing it, it works out pretty good.
Okay. What's on the calendar for you? I know you have an open house coming up, right?
Yeah, we have an open house coming up on October 15th, and it runs from 2 to 6:30 p.m. Stop by any time. We'll be giving out tours. You can meet members and staff. I'll be there. We're going to put out some refreshments. And it's a good time for anyone to come in, ask us questions, talk about what we're doing. If you want to participate with us, or if you have something that we can use or something that we can give to you, we can talk about that.
Is that $2 lunch open to the public, by the way?
I'm sorry, it's not. No, it's only open for the members. Yeah. I mean, if we actually have a food cart that we're trying to place. And it has a really good, we have a very, very good menu at the best prices in town. For example, our BLT sells for $7. That's the BLTs, chips, a drink, a cookie. And it's homemade right there as you watch.
That sounds great. So you're looking for a location for that?
Yes. Right now it's in storage out of Bobcat of Juneau, and it's waiting for us to get it out of there and put it in a spot and use it. We really want to use it not so much as a fundraiser, that kind of thing, but we want to use it as a job preparatory activity for the members. Get them out working with people, get used to being to work on time, and you know. One of the upsides for our food program is any of the members and staff that work in the kitchen, they have to have their food worker card through DEC. So that's a plus that they can put on a resume.
Sure. If somebody's listening right now and they're an employer and they would like to contact you, what's the best way to do that?
Best way to do that is by phone, and that number is 780-6775. Or you can just stop by 434 Willoughby Place anytime. We're open to visitors.
Okay. Bruce Van Dusen, he's the executive director of Polaris House. They have an open house coming up on October 15th. Go check things out. Or if you're an employer who is looking to help someone out with transitional employment, give them a call at 780-6775. Bruce, is there anything else you want to add?
One other thing. We have a volunteer board of directors, and that may be something that people in the community are interested in. We have a number of open seats. We can invite you to meet the board, take a tour, come on in. We'd be happy to accommodate you.
Great. Bruce, thanks for coming in today.
Welcome.
Down in New Orleans, they call the rising sun. It's been the ruin of many a poor boy and me. Oh God, I'm one. Mama, she worked for a tailor man. She sold all my new blue jeans, and my daddy was a gambling man in the town of Old New Orleans. Shuffle them cartridge. A suitcase or a trunk, and the only time he's ever satisfied is when he's on a drum. Boys, fill up your glasses right to the brim. Let the drinks flow merrily round. We'll drink to the health of a rounder poor boy who rambles from town to town. Now, fellas, don't believe what a bad woman tells you, though her eyes be blue or brown. Unless she's standing on some old scaffold high, same fellas, they won't let me come down. I've done, and to shun that old house down in New Orleans that they call the rising sun. Soon they'll take me back down to New Orleans, to face all the crimes that I've done. Then they'll tie me to an old ball and chain until my earthly race is run.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon on Monday, September 14th. It's about 20 minutes after the hour.
This is Bird Note. Toucans fascinate birders and non-birders alike. Imagine, though, what it must have been like when the first of these colorful, big-billed tropical birds reached European scientists for the very first time. The bright feathers, yellow and red and glossy black, drew universal admiration. That bill, though, was another matter. For nearly 300 years, European ornithologists described it as bizarre, grotesque, monstrous. Theories abounded about its function, for defense, for picking fruit, for hacking out nesting cavities. But many observers simply assumed that the toucan's bill was a burden, combining disproportion with uselessness. The most influential natural historian of the late 18th century, the Count de Buffon, agreed, but he went on to ask why such a creature should even exist. His answer was surprising. The toucan, he argued, like other freaks of nature, was created as proof of nature's unboundedness. Its weirdness is proof that the creative force is not restricted by human ideals of proportion or regularity. In its monstrosity, the toucan is definitive proof that nature is bigger and stranger than any of us. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Support comes from the Augustus Brown Swimming Pool, offering HydroFit every Tuesday and Thursday from 6:30 p.m. until 7:30, Aqua Aerobics Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. until noon, and Stretch Aquatics Tuesdays and Thursdays from 11 a.m. until 11:45. Fall swim schedules are now available online at juno.org/park/pool. More information at 586-5325.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, September 14th. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 23 minutes past the hour, and I have been joined in the studio now by a couple folks from Aware. We have Swarupa Toth. She's the legal manager over there. Welcome to the show, Swarupa.
Thank you.
And also Rachel Wintz. She's the volunteer coordinator at Aware. Welcome, Rachel.
Thanks.
All right. Swarupa, you want to start and give us a little overview of what's happening at Aware right now?
Well, it's a really exciting time at Aware. We have just started the school season. We have Girls on the Run starting up and our new program, Boys Run. So the third through fifth graders around the southeast area are really enjoying new coaches and running games and lessons where they play and learn things like, good boundaries, how not to be bullied, how to do bystander intervention. You may have heard that CASE has opened, our new transitional housing, and we're really excited about that. We've just started to have people to move in there for longer periods of time, which is really, really helpful to get your feet on the ground before you kind of re-enter into the world. And I guess the next exciting thing for us is, besides what Rachel and I are here to talk about, the advocacy training, is that Women of Distinction, our big annual fundraiser, which happens the first Saturday of March, which is far away, but the nominations for that are going to be due September the 25th. So if you know of a special woman who's done kind of behind-the-scenes hero kind of work to support and serve women and children of Juno, please get online at aware.org and look at our application for the nomination. That's really exciting.
Okay. And Swarupa, just in case somebody doesn't know about AWARE, tell us about the acronym and tell us briefly about what you do.
Yes. Well, AWARE's acronym is Aiding Women in Abuse and Rape Emergencies. And AWARE is not only a shelter that houses, we have about 48 beds, I think that's right, So we offer confidential services, shelter. We also, of course, have really healthy, beautiful food there. We have a couple of children's counselors. All of our services are free of charge. We have the prevention team, which does so much great work out in the schools. We have rural services. My job is to oversee some of the legal work. Let's see.
Sounds like a lot going on.
Yeah, it's so much I can't quite put an umbrella over it all. But, yeah, it's a beautiful organization.
And among the programs is this volunteer advocacy training. Rachel, you want to tell us about that?
Yes, so twice a year, Aware puts on an advocacy training. And our advocacy training is coming up. It starts this Saturday, September 19th. It's a 40-hour training, and it meets all day Saturday and Sundays, and then Monday and Thursday evenings for about 2 weeks.
Okay, and what kind of folks is this targeted at?
This is available to the entire community, so community members are welcome to come, staff at agencies that work with the same clientele as Aware. If you work with vulnerable populations, so women, children, the elderly, people with disabilities, it's a great training for you because those people are more likely to experience violence. It's also a training that we give to all our new staff at Aware, and we encourage lots of people who'd like to volunteer at Aware to attend the training as well.
I know this is a 40-hour course, and this may be hard to put your finger on, but what are a couple examples of strategies that folks might learn at this workshop?
Great. So we'll learn about a lot of different topics. We'll kind of learn about the history of the movement against domestic violence. We'll learn about what we do at Aware. So we'll learn about responding to sexual assaults, legal advocacy, services for children, what we do with men, our work with community partners and preventing violence. Then we'll also learn about things like substance abuse's relation to domestic violence, some cultural components about privilege and oppression, and for being an advocate for people who've experienced domestic violence. So we get really a broad picture of the different avenues that kind of intersect with domestic violence and sexual assault.
For our listeners, in case they're not going to attend this training, what is the best thing a person can do if they suspect that somebody has been abused? What's the first step?
I think the first step is to not judge, to simply listen. And these are the cornerstones of advocacy. Just to, you know, we spend time in the training learning about cultural norms and how those biases have sort of distorted our perception about victimization. And when somebody experiences domestic violence and or sexual assault, they really can cross over to survivorship in the environment of somebody who can listen to their experience, tell them they're not alone, to understand that this can happen, like Rachel was saying, and I think she has some statistics that show that this can happen to anyone. This isn't a reflection on something that you've done wrong. So victim blaming is a natural, I think, tendency to get into, to think, what did you do? Why did you do that? How did you cause this? But honestly, this is what's brilliant about the training, is that it really removes the veils of our own biases that we have, either culturally or to protect ourselves from the pain that this could happen to us or that this happened to a dear friend.
Okay. When does this workshop start, Rachel?
It starts this Saturday, September 19th at 8:30 in the morning, and it's held at Aware.
Okay. If somebody wants more information, where should they go?
They can contact Aware at 586-6623, and they can ask for Rachel W.
Okay. I wanted to back up. I know about Girls on the Run, this wonderful program. It seems to be having great success in the community. You also mentioned Boys on the Run. Can you give us some details on that?
So there's a distinction there. So Girls on the Run and Boys Run.
Okay.
It's tricky. But the full program name for Boys Run is Boys Run Itu'u Klatsin. And that second part stands for Strengthen Your Spirit. So this program was developed in a partnership between Aware and SAFE, which is the domestic violence agency in Sitka. And it came from the community asking, well, what do you have for boys? We see Girls on the Run. It's great. what do you have for boys? And so we actually developed this curriculum. It's similar to Girls on the Run in that it's a three-part curriculum. So the first part focuses on yourself, kind of dealing with emotions, identifying your values. The second part focuses on your team and building that team, working together with people. And then the third part focuses on community, and they do a small community service project in one of the lessons. Then they end in a 5K, and that 5K is going to be held on December 5th this year. So the Boys Run curriculum really integrates a lot of Southeast Alaska Native values in it.
Okay, if somebody wanted to get involved with that, with Girls on the Run, or wanted to take this volunteer advocacy training, who should they contact?
They can contact Rachel W. at AWARE.
Okay, sounds good. Anything else either of you would like to add?
We do. We always like to end that if you or someone you know has experienced domestic violence, sexual assault, or child sexual assault or abuse, please, please contact AWARE for free and confidential services. And the number is 586-1090. Or if you're calling from outside of Juneau, our toll-free number is 1-800-478-1090. Advocates are available 24/7. And we're also online at awareak.org.
Okay. Swaroop Patath, she's the legal manager at AWARE, and Rachel Wintz, she's the volunteer coordinator over at AWARE. Thank you both for coming on the show today. Anything else either of you'd like to add?
Thank you.
Thanks,
all
Scott.
All right. See you.
I heard an angel singing when the day was springing, mercy, pity, peace is the world's release. Thus is sung all day over the new. Down pour the heavy rain over the new reaped grain, and miseries increase as mercy, pity, peace. I heard an angel sing.
You're listening to a Juneau Afternoon here on Monday, September 14th, 2015. It's about 35 minutes after the hour.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 14th of September, 2015. Francis Scott Key wrote the words to the Star-Spangled Banner on this day in 1814. George Frederick Handel completed his oratorio Messiah on this date in 1741. The librettist Charles Jennens had given him the text back in July. It's the birthday of the critic Eric Bentley, born in Lancashire, England, 1916, who championed and translated the plays of Bertolt Brecht. It's the birthday of the physiologist Ivan Pavlov, born in Ryazan in central Russia, 1849. His father was the village priest, and Pavlov was going to go to seminary, and then he read Darwin's work, got interested in the study of science, got his medical degree, and left religion behind. He could not reconcile his passion for scientific proof with the life of faith. He went off to Moscow to the Imperial Medical Academy, where he was the chair of the physiology department, and there he studied conditional reflexes, not innate reflexes, instinctual reflexes, but conditional reflexes that are learned. And he did his famous experiments with dogs, who would salivate when the lab assistant came through the door with their food, and then would salivate when the lab assistant came in, whether the lab assistant had food or not. It's the birthday of Barbara Grizzuti Harrison, Queens, New York, 1934. She was a travel writer. Her parents came from southern Italy, from Calabria. She was an essayist, wrote autobiography, had a very troubled childhood, an abusive father, mother suffered from mental illness. Family joined the Jehovah's Witnesses, and Ms. Harrison renounced her faith at the age of 22, went off to Greenwich Village, lived the bohemian life, and began writing feminist essays. She came out with a memoir, 1978, Visions of Glory, A History and a Memory of Jehovah's Witnesses, in which she portrayed the faith as harsh and tyrannical and sexist. Though she was an agnostic when she began writing the book, she experienced a spiritual epiphany in the course of writing it and converted to Catholicism. Barbara Grizzuti Harrison, whose travel essays, particularly about Italy, are still very popular. Here's a poem for today by Mary Oliver, entitled Beauty. When the owl on her plush and soundless wings rises from the black waves of the oak leaves, or floats out of the needles of the pines that are moaning, that are tossing, I think, oh, she is beautiful, with her eyes like burning moons, with her feet like twisted braids of old gold flexing and curling, and I am glad to see her. Some wild loyalty has me to the root of the heart, even when she ruffles down into the field and jabs like a mad thing, and it's hopeless, it's also wonderful, so I thank whatever made her this beast of a bird with her thick breast and her shimmering wings, whose nest in the dark trees is trimmed with screams and bones, whose beak is the most terrible cup I will ever enter. Beauty, a poem by Mary Oliver from What Do We Know, published by DeCapo Press, used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory and problem-solving through online games, Lumosity.com, and by LegalZoom, providing legal help to Americans with online services, customer support, and independent legal advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Alaska Originals is proud to begin our production season with jazz trumpet player and composer extraordinaire Ingvil Vatngutu. She'll be accompanied by the Rob Cohen Trio for an hour of tasty jazz and conversation. KUCI Irvine once said, "This young woman creates the new jazz paradigm." Be part of the studio audience for this live television recording of Alaska Originals at 360 on Thursday, September 17th at 7 p.m. Tickets are $12 in advance at ktoo.org.
And speaking of that concert, we're about to talk about it right now here on a Juno afternoon. It's Monday, September 14th, 2015, 40 minutes after the hour. And in the studio with me now is Ingvill Vatn. Gutu, welcome to the show, Ingvill.
Thank you so much, Scott.
All the way in from Anchorage.
Yep, and Homer and beyond.
And also joining us in the studio, the one, the only, Mr. Clay Good.
It's good to see you. All the way from 7th Street.
All the way. All the way from downtown Juneau.
Yeah.
All right, you guys are going to be playing downstairs on Thursday night, and everyone's talking about this show.
Yeah.
It's going to be pretty hot.
Good, yeah. Looking forward to it. We hope that people will, you know, make good what they on their promises of showing up, and hopefully they get the tickets before so that they don't go home disappointed without a ticket.
Well, so when Clay played down there with the Rob Cohen Trio, that show sold out, and that was an awesome show. So I'm thinking it's going to sell out, and then with you added to the show,
well, that's what I'm not
leading
sure.
The show, it's gonna like double sell out.
It'll be quite a draw for sure.
That would be
fresh talent in town.
Who is here? Let's get tickets to Who.
No one's
going
to want to miss it. I know.
It's going to be fun. 7 o'clock this Thursday night. You can go to ktoo.org right now for tickets.
Yep.
I would go do that soon. It's $12 or $15 at the door.
There's a deal.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I know. It's almost
for live fund. Original composed music.
Yep.
Ingvill, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, okay. What should I start with? That's my counter question to that one, because I tend to have a lot to say.
You have roots.
Direct me.
In Oslo. You
yep.
have roots in New York.
Yep.
Anchorage.
Yep.
Toronto?
Any city with an O in it.
Yeah.
Or any city with more than O in it, like Toronto and Oslo and London. And New York, and yeah, no, there's
long musical history, musical family. Your main instrument's the trumpet, right?
Yeah.
But you play guitar.
Yeah, and other things. I mean, I think anyone can play anything, really. I mean, it just happened that I didn't get a job, so I had more time to practice all those instruments.
That's how that works.
That's how it works. So all of the rest of you guys with day jobs, just scrap the day jobs and be multi-instrumental. So right now, though, trumpet is the, you know, my big baby, and it's been at least 10 or 12 years where I've really not had any time to practice any other thing. So that's kind of what I do. So the last 5-6 years, I've focused on, and I'm a composer, I should say that. Maybe I'm more of a composer, really, than a performer, in the sense that I rate my own compositions. I'm not scared of people hearing my compositions, but I sometimes get nervous about playing in front of people, right? So I have a lot of confidence in my own music because I didn't write it. It was, you know, it was one of those, I channeled it. It just sort of plopped down, and I wrote it down, and I don't feel like I knew what was coming when any piece was coming. Mm. So it was, I'm very happy to have been there when those pieces were written. and so I like to present them.
And you're on CD number 3, is that right?
Uh-huh.
On the crosswalk?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
more coming.
Let's play a cut off of one just so can exemplify what you do.
Sure,
Set us up for, I think we have Broadway Bomb lined up.
Oh, okay,
set
Broadway
this one
Bomb.
Up a little.
Pretty eclectic title. Most of my pieces have some kind of history to them. I've written a lot of music for theater before I kind of concentrated on jazz. So, I am a little bit of a sort of storyteller. And this is a story of an illicit longboard race that takes place in New York every October. So it's coming up soon. People go from 125th Street in Harlem and all the way down to Wall Street. And it started about 15 years ago and were like 11 guys with beanies and longboards. Now it's 3,500 people that go, and the police are, you know, totally disparate.
Helpless.
It's totally, and NYPD do not know what to do, and the families and grandmas and, you know, everyone, all longboard enthusiasts, and they just go.
You can go on YouTube and see pictures of these crazy guys who just barge through taxis and pedestrians, tourists and whatever. So,
this is
a
the musical
tribute.
Version.
Yeah, if you just start, imagine it right from the beginning, you can hear the wheels spinning, and then they kind of go through Midtown, a little bit posher, and then some black places, some kind of other places, you know, and it just sort of goes through the different areas of Manhattan down to the finishing line.
Like the locals who bomb Gold Street.
Yeah. There you have it.
Where they are in the race right now.
Oh, yeah. Well, probably around about hundreds now.
And, you know, among other things I like about the CD is it does have a narrative arc. It's on the crosswalk, right? It's mm-hmm. sort of a journey through
yeah,
New York.
Definitely. Not say a million things at once. Yes, it has, if not an arc, it has a couple of different arcs, maybe. Kind of the first three, four tunes are pretty New York-y and urban, and then it goes in a little bit more maybe into some kind of introverted things about me and about being a person of the North and someone who likes nature and is nurtured by nature and someone is, you know, not afraid of checking into their feelings and things like that. And, then it sort of goes in and out of that and some of jokey stuff and my own kind of honest attempts of being jazzy and experimental, you know, and it's kind of a lot of different things. In fact, this album was a master's thesis at NYU, so I was torn between trying to fulfill, you know, how it is when you go back to school at a mature age, you're too old to really do that, but you're still trying a little bit to fulfill some kind of brief. So it's a little bit of a schizophrenic album in the sense that it comes, you know, it tries to combine that being in the city and also having a house in Homer.
Clay, you've been playing music with Yngwie a little bit over the last couple of years, it seems like. Tell us about how that's been. And
well, when Yngwie came by Juno and in the spring, we tried desperately to set up a gig. But, you know, sometimes getting a band together is like herding squirrels, particularly in the springtime. But the autumn's a great time for music. You know, the tourists are disappearing and everybody's kind of sticking around town. And it's a good time to get together and play music. And so the first time we played music together was Friday night at the Alaskan with an audience of unsuspecting patrons wondering, what is this going to be?
And patrons, that's so diplomatic.
They were prisoners of our music for an evening. So, I mean, that's kind of the great thing about jazz sometimes is how bare naked it can be. We just stepped up there cold and did what we could.
Mm-hmm. I'm still sorry about that, but I'm very proud of you. I mean, that was really almost could have been a nasty thing to do to you guys, but it
can be a little fearsome for certain. We weren't like playing standards that we know. I mean, Robert knows a million tunes, but mm-hmm. here we are faced with some really great compositions, really challenging compositions that that we've had a chance to run through before Yngwie got to town, but, you know, mostly just to scare ourselves by trying to play them. And because her pieces are formidable, and it's really exciting to be given the opportunity to take a stab at them, for sure.
Wow. Yeah. What can we expect on Thursday night, you two?
Well, we were talking about that last night or yesterday. We've been kind of trying to get together every day because we've got, you know, five. It's kind of like the wedding is on Thursday, and this is an arranged marriage, you know. And we're just trying desperately to figure out what each other likes and things like that before the big night, you know.
Yeah.
And
before we consummate.
Yeah. So that well, it's a family audience also, right? So let's okay. Yeah. So, but no, we agreed that we're going to really go for it. We're going to be fearless, but not stupid, as in the sense that we'll just want to play together, you know. And I think this is a really cool chance for everybody to get together and try to experience just being in the same space together when we make music. And that's what we need an audience for. We need people to come and give us kind of nonverbal feedback. When you listen, you're doing a lot more than you think. You know, we who play music, we feel how our music strikes you, and it's a kind of a nonverbal feedback back to us. And without an audience, it's really kind of, you know, it could be good just to meet each other, but you can expect to be part of an event that really is still, you know, kind of in the making, experimental, finding new things in the music that I probably know the music best, but maybe I don't by Thursday, you know, right? Maybe I'll find a lot of new things that Rob and Clay and Alexi are bringing to the show.
We'll do our part to turn a few of the tunes on their head for sure. Yeah.
Thank you.
And we do, you know, it is a live television recording, but we do like to encourage our audiences to give feedback. It's certainly, we don't want it to be a sterile
environment. No, that's great. Yeah. And we're going to be, you know, some of the tunes are going to be some not free improvs that are crazy, but there's a lot of room for everybody to contribute things there. Some tunes are more thoroughly composed, but there's a kind of a variety of approaches, but overall approach is, hey, what can we do with this? And, you know, an hour of jazz. Jazz meaning creative, friendly togetherness.
Yeah, collaboration. Communication, for sure, yeah.
Yeah.
I think part of what made Friday night and Saturday night at the Alaskan sort of fun was the folks who were there were surprised, you know, by the freshness of it. And, uh-huh. and I hope that that's what we bring to it Thursday.
Yeah. It's true. They really dug it, you know. People, I had not thought that all the patrons of the Alaskan were going to dig it, but they really did appreciate it, and I appreciate it, you know, so it became a really nice experience.
If you had to compare your jazz Yngwie to someone else, might be a hard question, but I did like one quote that I saw on your website, something you quoted Miles Davis. It's not the notes you play, it's the notes you don't play.
Yeah, well, I'm changing that because I'm getting better. let's see. That last part is actually true. I've kind of come to a little point of the last month where I've realized that what I've been practicing for about a year, new technique. I got a new mouthpiece. I've worked on a good friend of mine, Ingrid Jensen, who's a world's amazing trumpet player. She kicked my butt a lot when I go visit her, and she said this, and then I just said and then I run away, and I've been doing that for a year, and it's kind of paying off. So I'm trying to play more notes. But it's true. I do believe that it's not the point, really. I think as the composer of the tunes, I can already hear a lot of what's going on. Who was it that I listened to the other day? Jan Garbrek. Same thing, you know, you're an orchestrator on stage with the others, and you're just really trying to get everyone to move in the same direction. So who does that? I would like to compare myself to Miles Davis in the sense that you kind of give people freedom, but he was also scaring the heck out of his band members, and I take the opposite approach. I stroke them tremendously.
Lots of praise. and patience.
Yes. So I don't know. Style-wise, I think I'm all over the place. I'm experimenting a lot, but, you know, I have a Scandinavian background and kind of European, although I'm getting my feet into, you know, I like things by Ralph Alessi, Steve Tressler, Ingrid Jensen, her sister Christine, aspiring to be the new Maria Schneider in my next big band project. And so, you know, I kind of have started to hook into what's going on right now, which is kind of exciting. Otherwise, before I was going to say Mozart.
Yeah. All right. Well, this concert is this Thursday at 7 p.m. here in the K2 building in the At 360. So I think it's going to be a really good one. Ingvild Vatngutu and the Rob Cohen Trio. Cameras roll sharp at 7 p.m. Mm. So please make sure you're here before.
I will.
That. Yeah, Ingvild, we need you a little bit before 7. What else should we tell folks? Go to ktoo.org for the tickets. It's going to be an awesome show.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to have CDs for sale. I even have T-shirts. And people can just come with all that merch that they didn't get a chance to get all the month before. You know, they just, now is the time to buy. You know, you're going to get your dividends soon.
It's the holiday season.
Yeah, the holiday
Support
season.
Support an Alaskan musician.
Yeah. If people want to listen to my music in advance to go, what, who is this person? I have a website, which is yvgmusic.com. And you can go there and you just can also look up my name on iTunes and all these places. And you can hear little snippets of it. Of course, it's not the same as hearing it live, and we are in Juneau. The albums are recorded in New York and Anchorage. So different musicians, different vibes, but you know, you get an idea if people are curious.
Clay, what should we expect from you?
Oh, from me, you should expect me to be watching furiously as I hold on by the skin of my teeth.
Triplets, lots of triplets.
Yes.
It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank
I wish
you.
We had more time.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, I'll see you on Thursday night at 7 p.m.
Yeah.
Right
be
on.
There.
All
Thank
right.
you. See ya.
Thank you for tuning in to a Juneau Afternoon here on Monday, September 14th, 2015. It's been a fun show. Tomorrow, Ben Brown is going to be your host. Pam Leary will be here to highlight the Juneau Skating Club. And he'll talk with Melinda Moustakis. She's here to give a presentation to the 49 Riders Group. And we'll get an update on activities with the Juneau School District. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more. Live at 3 on KTOO News. Repeated at 4 on KRNN. And always online via ktoo.org. It is currently 49 degrees at the Juneau Airport. Tonight, numerous showers, lows around 43. Tomorrow, Tuesday, showers, heavy at times in the afternoon, highs around 51. Wednesday, showers, highs around 53. And Thursday, showers, highs around 53. Thanks for tuning in to a Juneau Afternoon.